Jews arrived at the dawn of the coal era. The first Jewish settler came to the New River boom town of Sewell, West Virginia, in 1871. First, let's talk about the journey they had to make from places like Russia, the Ukraine, Lithuania, just to leave those places and make it to Appalachia.
Right, and people had all different kinds of reasons for leaving Eastern Europe, but the main reasons were the terrible economic conditions that existed there at that time, and also the fact that the horrible economy, Jews were basically being made a scapegoat for a lot of the social and economic turmoil of the day, and they were, there were pogroms or riots against Jews, a lot of governmental restrictions, and it just became very, very, very difficult to live in Eastern Europe as a Jew at that time. And so people started immigrating, and what started as a trickle became a huge mass migration of some 2 million people from Eastern Europe to America between the 1880s and 1920s, which was the exact same time as the coal boom. Mm-hmm. And what I talk about in my book is that these two historic events that occurred at exactly the same time were not, totally disconnected, because some Jews did find their way to Appalachia. Once they made it over to the U.S., they had to make livings for themselves and figure out how they were going to fit into the U.S. Economy and culture. And through mostly Jewish networks, they managed to make it out to the region. And those who did established a niche as merchants in the growing economy that that had come to the region because of the coal industry.
But the relationship was pretty tenuous, I gather, between the Jewish businessmen mm-hmm. and their families and the coal industry.
Right. Jews were sort of, they had a kind of a funny role because they were some of the few people who really weren't involved in the coal industry. I mean, here you had an industry that was pretty much overwhelmingly dominated southern West Virginia and southeastern Kentucky. In that period, say the 1890s to 1930s, and of course after that as well. And because Jews came with their own networks, they were often sent out by wholesalers in places like Baltimore who knew that there was a growing market for consumer goods and sent Jews, they sent their sort of fellow immigrants out to peddle in these areas. And so Jews established a niche that was outside of the coal industry. And then they had to deal with things like company stores. The coal companies didn't always welcome independent merchants and the competition they brought. So, they had to face certain kinds of difficulties that, people elsewhere didn't have to face. One thing that I focus on in my book is how the Jewish merchants related to the coal industry in a variety of different ways.
In what ways?
Well, for one thing, there was the competition with company stores. Some coal companies were adamant that independent merchants, Jewish or non-Jewish, it really didn't relate to ethnicity at all, were adamant that there would be no competition and would try to make sure that there were no independent merchants in their area. But others were not so diligent in trying to remove independent merchants. Mm-hmm. And there was kind of an accommodation of sorts in some areas. When it came to competition with company stores, independent merchants had to sort of develop their own strategies, how they would match or, compete with company stores, whether they would accept scrip. I found that independent merchants often did accept coal company scrip in their stores because when miners came into shop, that's all they had. Mm-hmm. And then the question became, well, what do you do with this scrip? You can't just take it to a bank. A bank isn't going to accept it. So in some cases, they would actually, the merchants would go to the company stores themselves with the scrip and then buy goods that they would turn around and sell in their own stores.
Oh.
So there was, a variety of, different little ways to get around the sort of peculiar features of the coal field economy.
How many Jews were in the coal fields in Appalachia at its height?
Well, at its height, I don't think we're really talking more than, a few thousand people. It's kind of hard to get a grasp of, I think the height was probably, the late 1940s, right before the mechanization, during the World War II era and after. So the area that I'm focused on is basically southern West Virginia, southeastern Kentucky, and a little bit of southwestern Virginia. And probably in those towns, which were like Welsh, Logan, Beckley, Williamson. You know, you're just talking about really a few hundred people in each town. So at any one time, you know, maybe only a few thousand. But between that whole time period of the 1880s to, say, 1970s, you know, you're talking about thousands of people who actually passed through and stayed for a generation or two until after the economy really sort of went downhill with the mechanization of the coal mines in the 1950s.
When they first arrived and started to open their business and started to be members of their communities, was there discrimination? How were they treated?
I really didn't find that there was any discrimination against Jews. For one thing, as I said before, these were growing areas, mm-hmm. and their skills as merchants were needed in places like the county seats, and they were welcomed in many cases. I think there was, some prejudice against Jews, just as there was prejudice against some of the other immigrant groups that mm-hmm. came to the region. But not what I would think of as an inordinate amount, mm-hmm. and not enough to chase anybody away or mm-hmm. anything like that.
One of the things I like to talk about when I talk about Appalachia is, well, two things: music and food. Mm-hmm. Now, we think of Appalachian music, we think of the Scots-Irish heritage that mm-hmm. gave us kind of the Appalachian sound with the fiddle and the banjo and the mandolin. What about Eastern Europe? Did they bring some musical traditions with them?
Well, I hadn't heard anybody really talk to me about that too much.
That's okay. What about food? They had to bring their own traditions and
right.
their own recipes. And how do you keep kosher in Appalachia?
Right. When Jews came to the region, they were basically Orthodox Jews who were used to keeping kosher and keeping the Sabbath and basically following all the traditional tenets of their religion. And they did try to keep kosher. To do so, you'd have to have a shochet, which is a kosher slaughterer, to slaughter chickens and, to meat and that kind of thing. And there were some of these men who came into the region to do that. But it wasn't consistent. They would just sort of pass through, and it was very hard to maintain a kosher household in the coal fields. Sometimes they would order food from Charleston or from Cincinnati or Baltimore. They'd order food to come on the train, and sometimes it would come and it'd already be spoiled, so they would have a problem there. But they would also do things like organize trips, like if Passover was coming, they might organize a trip where a bunch of people would go to Baltimore and purchase the kind of holiday foods that they wanted to have for the Jewish holidays and bring it back. So I would say in the first generation, they really tried to keep kosher. But then in succeeding generations, it just became harder and harder, and most people basically gave it up, which actually is the same, throughout much of America.
Mm-hmm. So. You are a research historian and family history coordinator mm-hmm. at the Jewish Museum of Maryland in Baltimore. What did you learn in writing this book that you didn't know before?
Oh, well, everything. Mm-hmm. I had the same sort of misconception that other people did when I first came to the region, and I was shocked to find that there were Jews living in these small towns. So just the diversity of the Jewish experience, and also I had the same misperceptions about Appalachia that other people have. Just the fact that this was a very, very diverse place, and I also learned about how people can successfully get along amidst such diversity. Because in the coal fields, you had people from all different kinds of groups, and basically they got along fairly well. So mm-hmm. that was somewhat surprising and heartening. And it's kind of a fun thing to study something that's despite the class issues that were going on and the labor problems, on a social level, people got along pretty well, and that was kind of heartening.
I was just going to ask you about that, the unionization of the coal fields.
Mm-hmm.
Did the Jewish merchants take any sides?
Well, I think the traditional view is that, the traditional historian's view is that the middle classes and upper class sort of were on the same side against the working class. But what I found is that the Jews who had come there and had established this economic niche as, sort of in the middle, really felt caught in the middle during times of labor conflict.
Mm-hmm.
As merchants, they basically Everybody was their customers. They didn't want to alienate anybody. They could see in a lot of cases what how coal miners were being treated, especially in the era before unionization. So they felt very uncomfortable, sort of trapped in the middle between the two sides, and tried not to, they just tried to get along with everybody. That's what people I interviewed would tell me over and over again. Well, we tried to get along with everybody and not take sides. Often that wasn't possible, and I think when they were forced to take sides, basically they sided with, the coal companies and sort of in the middle class and the county seats. There was basically an attitude that, the coal miners were very radical, or there were outside agitators that were coming in and, causing all this trouble. And that kind of propaganda did have its effect on the middle class in the county seats, of which Jews were a part.
The Jewish community did thrive in Appalachia. However, you write only two of the nine congregations profiled in this book still exist, mm-hmm. both in much a reduced form. Mm-hmm. Can you explain?
Yes. Well, first of all, I have to explain that I only studied very, very small towns and congregations.
Yes.
Charleston and Huntington were not included in my study, and those both today have very thriving Jewish populations. But these smaller towns, the county seat towns like Welsh, Logan, and Beckley, and Williamson, once mechanization hit of the coal industry, and there was, as you know, a huge exodus from those areas because there was just no work to be had. And for the merchants, once your customers leave, then your business is going to go downhill too. So Beckley today is really the only, of all the small towns I studied, the only town that still has, a thriving small congregation. When I first wrote the book, Williamson had a congregation also, but I think it's sort of aging too. And I think there are a few people in Williamson left who are keeping up the congregation, but I really don't expect that to last. Beckley, on the other hand, because of the tourism boom in the New River area and hospitals and that kind of thing, continues to get new Jewish population, people coming in and joining Temple Beth El, which is really a great little congregation that's still very, very active.
You have a picture of that synagogue in your book.
Yeah, the synagogue was built in 1935. It's a very cute little building, and it's a beautiful little congregation. So,
we've talked a lot about West Virginia. The same occurred in eastern Kentucky as well, where merchants moved into the coal fields and then the coal towns and struggled with the coal companies and
right.
sought their fortunes in becoming merchants and peddlers.
Right. In southeastern Kentucky, there were congregations in Middlesboro and in Harlan, Kentucky. They didn't grow as large, partly because those coal fields developed a little bit later than the ones in southern West Virginia. And by the time they developed in the 1910s, most Jewish immigrants who were out there looking for opportunities had already arrived. So they didn't get as much of an influx of immigrants as the West Virginia towns.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, they pretty much followed the same trends of establishing congregations and surviving into the 1960s and 1970s.
And southwestern Virginia?
And southwestern Virginia, well, actually the very first small congregation in the coalfields was at Pocahontas, Virginia, which was the first town in the Pocahontas coalfield, the first coal town. And Pocahontas, Virginia, from there the coalfield spread into McDowell County, West Virginia. So Pocahontas, had a very lively Jewish community as early as 1890, and it was the first of the congregations that I studied. But by the 1920s, a lot of the people, the Jewish population of Pocahontas, had actually moved to Bluefield, where many of their descendants are still living to this day. Bluefield is another congregation that I looked at. It's also a thriving congregation today in southern West Virginia, mm-hmm. But a lot of the families in Bluefield did have a strong connection to families in places like Welsh and Pocahontas, and so I found some fascinating things in the county courthouses in McDowell, Fayette counties. And
what kinds of things?
Well, sort of court cases about, I found that the first settler to in Sewell, West Virginia, who is Arnold Middleburg, and the Middleburg family is still sort of well-known in southern West Virginia today. For example, he even engaged in a feud with another person, and the case ended up in court, and there were all these petty, you know, little misdemeanors back and forth as they sort of attacked each other, which was kind of amusing. I said, well, the Jews fit in perfectly well. They were having feuds, you know, just like everybody else.
Just like the Hatfield and McCoy feuds.
Right. Not on that scale, certainly. But
Deborah Weiner, author of Coal Field Jews and Appalachian History, thanks so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks a lot for interviewing me.
Coal Field Jews and Appalachian History is published by the University of Illinois Press.